Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1 p.m. and that is Pacific Summertime, and today is March 15th. Well, I thought we'd kick off in Asia this morning, and the Chinese market was down about 2%, and it was the worst performing index of all the major asset classes. But it's still consolidating here in the region of the trend mean, so it hasn't quite broken down yet. And there is still scope that it will find support or continue to find support around this psychological 5,000 big round number. And that's also coinciding with the upper side of the underlying range. So there's certainly some evidence of risk coming out of the market in China. And part of the reason for that is because there's expectations that the credit cycle is going to start to turn lower. We've had a meaningful jump higher in property prices. I think it's just worth keeping at the back of one's mind that the most popular asset in China is property. In Europe, it's bonds, and in the USA, for example, it's stocks. And when the vast majority of people and investors in a region own the asset class, well, then that is the most important to policymakers as well. So when property prices jump higher, then that is something that will translate into public policy in China to try and curtail credit growth. So that may be what the stock market is beginning to reflect. Then when we think about what's going on, for example, in the stock market, then what happens with banks is obviously then going to be a knock-on as well. And the banks sector was positive. So banks should at least continue to do reasonably well because of the interest rate differential. One thing that China enjoys better than anyone else is that they have a positive real rate. You certainly don't have positive real rates in the USA or Europe or Japan. So the fact that you do have that in China should be broadly supportive of the banking sector. And the banks have been outperforming. So there is another way of thinking about this. It may, in fact, be that we're also seeing a rotation in China similar to the rotation that we're seeing in Wall Street, out of some of the most high-flying stocks, and Kui Chao Mutai is probably one of the most recognizable. The big drinks company has certainly been pulling back in a dynamic manner, and it is weighing on the outlook for the CSI 300 simply by virtue of the fact that it's the largest constituent, or at least one of the largest constituents. Then when we turn our attention to what's going on in Japan, the Japanese yen continues to weaken, and the dollar is strengthening against it. It is coming back up to test that sequence of lower rally highs, and that downtrend has been in evidence now since 2015. It's coincided with the adoption of the Bank of Japan of a yield curve control policy. But there is some speculation that the Bank of Japan might be getting ready to ease up on that yield curve control, and they might be willing to tolerate a somewhat higher yield. Well, that's weighing on the currency, because if the Bank of Japan, which is the central bank that has the most experience of dealing with outright deflation for decades, is now starting to begin to alter policy and potentially to give just even a smidgen of credulity to the potential that we're entering a more inflationary period, well, that's good news for banks. And the Topics Banks Index popped again on the upside in here today. I think we need to get lots of back history here, because it has bounced now from that 100 area on three separate occasions. It didn't quite get down to 100 in 2003, and then we had this epic advance where it went from 116 to 500 in the space of about 2.5 years. It had a mini recovery back in 2012 through 2015 and gave it all up. And now we're in another similar recovery. Back in 2013 through 15, it was some of the regional banks that did best. And Shinsei Bank is the best performing constituent, and it has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs in pretty emphatic fashion. So we may be for a repeat of what we saw in the period from 2012 through to 2015. Because back then, people really did believe that Abenomics would be revolutionary and it would usher in a new period of vitality for the Japanese economy. Of course, the challenge back then was that the rest of the world was still in a disinflationary period. So Japan was not only experiencing domestic deflation, but also importing deflationary forces from overseas. Now, when we think about the world, there's probably no country is more levered to the positives of an inflationary cycle than Japan is. And it would appear that the stock market is responding in kind. So the Nikkei also remains quite firm. It's pausing around the psychological 30,000 level, but this remains a clear recovery candidate overall. Then when we look at some of the Asian currencies, well, we know that the yen has been weakening and the renminbi has been pausing. Now, the renminbi was stronger the last couple of days, it was stronger last week, weaker the last couple of days, but then there's also some weakness coming through in some of the other regional currencies. So, for example, the Taiwan dollar has now, it's at least it potentially in the process of breaking its trend. There's been a very clear trend of outperformance since the middle of 2019, and the currency has appreciated by approximately 10%. So now there is the scope, at least, for a reversion back towards the mean. Then when we look at the Korean won, the won has already completed its reversion back towards the mean. So now the question is it going to start to firm once more from this area, or have we seen a clear break of the trend and we're in for a more rangy environment overall? I think that's important because the dollar is steady, and it's steady against the euro as well. Of course, we're definitely in a period of time where nobody wants a strong currency. Some are willing to do more to achieve a weaker currency than others, and certainly the USA is right at the front of the pack in terms of countries that want a weaker currency. But there's certainly a lot of trading around that can take place in the currency markets before trends start to evolve because of this competitive devaluation environment. What we are starting to see, though, is that the commodity-related currencies continue to do well. The Australian dollar has found support above the 75 cent level and the trend mean, and it remains on a recovery drive overall. Now the ruble is also starting to strengthen up here, and it was at a new recovery high in here today. The Russians are talking about raising interest rates, and inflation is exceeding the target of about 4% and doing so in a pretty dynamic manner. And then there's also some speculation that Brazil will have to raise interest rates. So now the question is whether they will in fact follow through on it. The Brazilian real did bounce last week, but it was weak in here today. So if we perhaps see the currency breaking lower, then that might encourage the central bank to act to try and arrest the decline. There's certainly also potential that countries like Indonesia, which has seen a reversion back to the mean as well, may also be looking at tightening faster than other places. When we think about, well, why is Russia thinking about raising interest rates? Well, the recovery in the oil price will certainly have had an impact on that. And the oil price was weaker in here today, but not in a dynamic manner. It is pausing around the $70 level and the peak from early 2020. And of course, a lot more oil becomes economic at $70 than it was at $20. There's usually about a 3-month lag before we start to see a lot more of that oil coming to market. Natural gas prices have been pulling back, however, and they are now right in the region of the trend mean. So there is a lot of cold weather that has come to bear on the USA in particular. But now if this trend of appreciation is going to persist, well, this is an ideal level where we might anticipate some support starting to come back in. Commodities generally have been on a recovery scenario. So there is a lot of anticipation for demand in industrial resources like nickel. The price pulled back really very violently about 2 weeks ago, and it is steadying now in the region of the trend mean. When then we think about how some of the other metals like tin have been outperforming, well, it continues to hold this move around the 25,000 level, and it's been ranging below that level since 2012. So we're looking at a 9-year range, and there is the potential here that this could form the first step above that base as we move back into a reflationary global economy. Central banks all over are we're starting to see some beginning to think about raising rates, but we're still in a benign monetary environment, and governments are spending money like it was water. I did create this combined deficit spending metric about 18 months ago, and it certainly didn't work right there. So let me see if I can pull that up again. It isn't something that updates every day. And that is because deficit figures aren't really reported all that often. But the important point is that it is up now to about 1.3 trillion, and that has contracted somewhat from where it was in 2020, but levels now are still considerably above where they had been back in the 2010 period, and this looks like an uptrend overall. So we're going to see a lot more deficit spending, and that's likely to be global in nature, particularly from the developed markets with the less favorable demographics. And eventually that is likely to have an impact on bonds. And we've certainly seen that there's been a significant move higher in the bond prices, in bond yields. Now that did moderate a little in here today, but a 2 basis point move is certainly not enough to question the uptrend in yields. When we think about what's going on, well, investors are both pricing in global reflation and also the potential that interest rates will have to be dragged higher to compensate investors and force them to buy. But bond traders are of the opinion that they'll just continue to short until they force the central bank to, in fact, intervene. There isn't really any other reason, there isn't an urgency to buy right now when you don't have the surety that you'll be backed up by the central bank, because the value is just not there. When then we think about how does this all play into assets? Well, we know that the dollar is steady, but that there is still a competitive devaluation going on. We know that there is a great deal of money getting printed, and 1.9 trillion is about to roll off the printing presses and into people's bank accounts and into the bank accounts of states all over the USA. So that's a lot of spending. It's 8% of GDP has just been permissioned, so that is helping to support the stock market. The NASDAQ was in positive territory in here today. The Dow Jones, however, is continuing to march higher, and it tacked on another 174 points in here today. So this continues to look like an impressive market overall. What I find particularly interesting is that the S&P is now pushing on to another new all-time high. but that Bitcoin was not quite able to hold its move above the $60,000 level. Now, it did pair the decline today. But one of the defining characteristics of Bitcoin's trend over the course of the last year has been that breakouts were sustained. We have ample evidence of ranges, and we can see that every time we've had a breakout, then it has not dipped back into the underlying range. And that was equally true of the big range that formed in February and March. And now this one is dipping down. Now, this is potentially still just a consolidation in the region of the previous peak. However, if we see downside follow through, well, then that will signal a failed upside break. Now, failed upside breaks tell us one thing above all else, and it is that the vacuum of supply above the range has not formed. And you need a vacuum of supply to form above the range in order for a breakout to occur. So if there's no vacuum of supply, it means that there is plenty of supply, plenty of people willing to sell at 60,000. And obviously then, if there is still plenty of people willing to sell at that level, it means that we may have to range a while longer before the next breakout occurs. But if we get downside follow through, well, then the people that were hoping for the break above 60 have probably been stopped out. They'll be more cautious, less willing to go off and buy within size. So then they might wait for a dip in order to get back into the market. The most natural place to dip would be down towards the lower side of the range. So that's what we often see. We often see that a failed break will often go back down and test the lower side of the range. And then, of course, the question is whether it will find support there, because we've had the inconsistency. And failed upside breaks are generally a sign that supply and demand are coming back into balance. But sentiment is very much of the opinion that Bitcoin should do nothing but go up and go up indefinitely. But of course, the price of anything is set at the margin. And in order for prices to continue to trend higher in an aggressive manner, then they need successively larger waves of new liquidity. And we know where the last one came from. It was in anticipation of the big stimulus from the USA. So now the next question is, where is the next round or the next wave of additional new money going to come from? Because it's a lot harder to move Bitcoin today than it was a year ago. It's now a $1 trillion asset class, and that is putting it on par with some of the largest companies in the world. So you need big institutional flows to move a market like that. And that means that its institutions now are going to have to play a part. It can't simply continue to rely on retail investors. The most important thing, though, is that there has been a correlation between Bitcoin and Wall Street. So if Bitcoin is pulling back and Wall Street is continuing higher, well, then it raises the question, is the Bitcoin price just coming down one day is probably not enough to act as an immediate correlation. So there is that. If Bitcoin, however, breaks downwards, well, it could perhaps have more of an effect on sentiment. Then, of course, there is the fact that there is a clear rotation going on inside Wall Street, because we can think about the performance of companies like Apple, where it has pulled back to the region of the trend mean, and it is steadying here around the 120 area, so that is certainly good news. But then we can think about small caps, and they are doing substantially better. And the Russell has continued to push on to new high ground. I did think that this was a very interesting chart, which is that the Russell 2000 NASDAQ ratio overlaid with the 10-year yield. So it clearly demonstrates that the growth element of the market is highly correlated with bond prices. And bond prices are really quite oversold. So the potential here then is that they're due a bounce, but we haven't really seen much evidence of that coming through in here just yet either. Now, when we go back and think about what's happening in Europe, well, there's a lot at play here. The EU is taking the UK to court and complaining about the regulatory box-ticking exercises to go along with Brexit. The Europe Stoxx 600, which is a pan-European index, is still right in the region of the upper side of this 21-year range. And there is the clear potential here that we're looking at the scope for a significant breakout. Again, inflationary pressures rising is also beneficial for stocks in Europe. And the global reflation overall should also start to benefit Europe in particular, since they're so focused on economic expansion. There is also, of course, the clear potential that Europe will benefit from the return of the tourist market. It's the place it's probably the place with the most countries that have got the greatest dependence on tourism. And that's certainly been something that weighed on Europe generally in 2020, and then they've got the potential to come out of this in rather robust fashion. Obviously, there is some questioning of the efficacy data for AstraZeneca, because a number of countries have decided that they're just not going to use it, despite the fact that their respective regulatory bodies have permissioned it. But that has also been positive for the other vaccine producers. So Moderna was in positive territory today. The biotech ETF continues to rebound from the region of the trend mean. I do think that this whole vaccine question is a massive proof of concept for the wider market. There was, though, the interesting question about Bluebird. And the share did fantastically well in 2015 and again in 2017 and 18 around enthusiasm about immuno-oncology. But they have also experienced more recently some questions about whether their solution is in fact creating additional cancers in some of their patients. So that's obviously a challenge, and it has weighed on the sector. Well, what it means is that we don't have just a blank check for biotech, that there will be bumps along the road, and that obviously there is a massive market opportunity. And this is, I think, the more important point, that we will have certainly some companies do fantastically well and others won't, but that overall the sector will benefit. And there will be a value proposition as these technologies are proven to be commercially viable. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.